Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the New York Times, coming soon to a fruit bowl near you, by Claire Maldarelli. People like to talk about fruit as nature's candy, but here's a secret. Most of the fruits we buy at the store aren't found in nature. They're a product of science, and that's because a lot of the fruit that grows in the wild isn't especially pleasant to eat, says John Clark, a plant biologist. So scientists like him breed new varieties to be extra delicious and easy to eat. If you ever enjoyed seedless watermelon or big plump raspberries, you have plant science to thank. Ever had a grape that tastes like cotton candy? Yep, more science. Here's how it's done. First, pick the perfect parents. Making a new fruit doesn't begin in a lab. Scientists have to start from fruits that already exist. Just as you might get your mom's hair and your dad's eyes, every fruit inherits traits, like tartness or sweetness, from its parents through their genes. So scientists carefully choose two parent fruits based on what traits they want a new fruit to have. To create the cotton candy grape, Clark selected one parent with a great firm texture and another with a distinctly sweet flavor. Next, mash them up, not literally. Next up, a scientist removes pollen from one parent, which contains that parent's genes. Then they dust it onto the flower of the other parent, where it mixes with the other plant's genes. When the new fruit grows, its seeds will contain genes from both parent plants. But there's no telling yet which ones inherited all of the traits the scientists are looking for. Next, plant the seeds. Scientists plant the seeds, sometimes hundreds. When a seedling grows, they pick the first leaf off it and sequence its DNA in the labs to see if it carries all the genes for the specific traits they want. If it does, then let it grow. Fourth, taste and tweak. Whether or other factors can affect how the fruit turns out, says James Luby, a plant biologist. Kyle Rack, a raspberry breeder at Driscoll, says he taste tests hundreds of berries each year. If the flavor or texture is off, the whole process starts again. It can take 15 years to get it right. Finally, time to grow. Once the fruit is perfected, there's one last problem, Rack says. There's only one plant of it in existence in the world. To make enough to actually sell to consumers, companies might send their new seeds to breeders to plant on their farms. Then, after a long while, like a decade or two, you might find the fantastic new fruit at the grocery store. Whew! Worth the wait. From the Arizona Republic, from mowing height to when to water, four spring lawn care tips by Paul Capiello. An overly saturated lawn during spring months can lead to poor root growth. Spring is a time for magnolias, daffodils, dogwoods, and such. Other than throwing a big bag of weed and feed out there in spring, most people think of lawns as a summer thing, but spring is key to a quality lawn. It's key to setting the lawn up to best handle the heat and drought and all the other insults we all know are coming down the road. But these days, even the mention of a turf grass lawn at a cocktail party can get you tarred and feathered by self-appointed neighborhood enforcers. Lawns are Beelzebub incarnate, they say. Zero biodiversity, zero sustainability, zero socially redeemable qualities. I beg to differ. I have long been a defender of the lawn. It's a wonderful invention. Try fielding a ground ball on an infield of wildflowers. Kicking a soccer ball around the yard with the kids? Good luck on that one, too. That's what parks are for, they might say. Well, that's all fine and good if you happen to have a well-maintained city park half a block from your house. Sure, lawns viewed in a bubble don't offer much biodiversity. They don't offer precious honeybees much nectar to harvest. Certainly, someone sitting on a gas-powered mower 10 or 12 hours a week to mow 10 acres of lawn just for the heck of it doesn't make much sense. But lawns don't exist in a bubble. Integrated into a well-planned, diverse, and varied landscape, lawns can be part of a kind of solution that seems so rare these days, a reasoned, intentional, and reasonable balance of varied interests. And if a lawn happens to encourage parents to get outside with their kids for a game of ball, maybe lawns even strengthen families. But now to the lawn itself. There are four main components that contribute to a quality lawn. And understanding each is essential to maintain a quality and ecologically sensible lawn. How to improve soil quality in your lawn. Okay, this is the toughest one. It's not very realistic to expect a new homeowner to excavate 3 feet of compacted construction rubble that so often exists as soil surrounding most residential homes, especially newly constructed homes. The only other approach is to employ what cultural measures you can to slowly and over time improve the soil environment below your lawn. Using a mulching mower, a mower that carves up those leaf blades into tiny, quickly broken down pieces, is a great place to start. As those grass blades slowly decompose, they release organic acids to the soil that help to improve soil structure, aeration, and drainage. It's a slow process, but it does work over the long haul. In addition, managing your mowing height can greatly improve root growth and in turn help to move organic matter deeper into the soil horizon. So how often should you water your lawn? Overly saturated soil in spring can lead to poor root growth and predispose lawns to be overwhelmed by weeds and attacked by certain diseases. But you can't just turn off the spring rains, so how can you alleviate overabundance of water this time of year? The best answer is by managing surface water. We always hear about grading soil to direct water away from the house's foundation, but we can do the same for the lawn. If you have the potential to do some grading work, that's a great fix. The more water you can keep from puddling in lawn areas, the better. But there's another source of excess water that can lead to lawn problems, your downspouts. Most houses come equipped with those 24-inch long gutter extenders that do a great job of directing the water away from the foundation, but deposit all that storm water right onto the lawn. Extending the downspouts to the curb or to a designated rain garden area through buried drain pipe can help a great deal. And if you go this direction, do yourself a favor and skip the cheap black corrugated pipe. It almost always collapses over time. Use a good quality PVC pipe with nice smooth sides. You'll be glad you did. So which fertilizer should I use this spring? As our houses continue to get bigger and our lots smaller, it gets harder and harder to even think about allowing all the rainfall on your plot of land to percolate into the soil. Some is going to run off and end up in a storm drain or local creek. If you're not careful, it will carry fertilizer nutrients along with it. Not a good thing for our collective interest in good water quality. And fertilizing a lawn can be a tricky thing. It's easy to get a soil test that will tell you much about the nutrients available to your growing grass. But for nitrogen, the most important nutrient when it comes to lawn health, a soil test normally tells you little to nothing. You can get recommendations on nitrogen needs from cooperative extension publications and elsewhere, but those recommendations don't always tell you how to apply. Any fertilizer applied incorrectly can lead to much, if not all of it, getting washed away in a spring thunderstorm. Organic fertilizers that break down and make nutrients available slowly over the course of the growing season mean less of it running off into local streams. Soluble fertilizers are easily dissolved and washed away by strong spring rain, so if you do use soluble mineral fertilizers, apply in small doses. I usually recommend 1/3 to 1/4 of package recommendations per application, applied in 2 or 3 week intervals rather than all at once. Avoid applying before a significant rain. Apply when there's little chance of rain and then gently water in with a sprinkler or irrigation system. How high should I cut my grass? Well, this is one of the most important ways to build a healthy lawn and reduce weed growth. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that the lowest height adjustment holes on your lawnmower should never be used. The lower you cut your lawn, the more you favor the weeds. The lower you cut your lawn, the shallower the roots of your grass plants. The lower you cut your lawn, the more likely you will spend July and August pushing your lawnmower through a cloud of dust. A 4-inch mowing height doesn't mean you have to cut the lawn more often. It just means you'll have a healthier and a happier lawn. Here's another article that appeared in the Arizona Republic. Go Big When Growing Tomatoes in Pots by Amy Dodd Thompson. Growing tomatoes in containers, actually growing just about anything in a container rather than in the ground, presents the double-edged sword of horticulture. On the plus side, container culture gives the gardener lots of options and tons of control. Junk soil in the backyard? No problem. Anywhere you have the better part of a day of sun, a little space, and access to water, you can grow a great tomato. On the other hand, growing tomatoes in containers brings certain challenges. There's little room for error in your watering. Miss a day at the wrong time of the season, and there goes a whole lot of work down the drain. You need to pay more attention to fertilization and nutrition when growing tomatoes in containers. And you can't just grow any old variety, not if you want to keep your sanity. Here are four questions answered about growing great tomatoes in containers. Question: what is the perfect container you can use to grow tomatoes? And the answer: here's a simple exercise to get you going in the right direction. Go out to the garage or potting shed and find your largest container. Drag it out to the driveway, hose it off, and sanitize it with a 50% bleach solution. Then throw it back into the shed. It's too small. I grow one tomato plant per year. I grow it in the only spot of sun in my entire yard. I grow the plant in a container since that sunny spot is on the driveway. The container is a full 36 inches in diameter. Successful container culture requires that you hit the proper balance of root zone volume to top growth tonnage. You want sufficient volume to allow for once-a-day watering. Remember, one mild wilting event will set a plant back at least a week. So, with rare exceptions, the bigger the better. In fact, if you can't find a big enough proper container, go to the farm store and get one of those big galvanized troughs to use as a container. Just be sure to drill some big holes in the bottom for drainage. Here's the next question. Should you use bagged potting mix? Bagged soil-less mixes provide the needed drainage and porosity characteristics to keep your plants from drowning in their own irrigation. They are usually sterilized or pasteurized to eliminate or at least greatly minimize disease and pest problems. Some of you even come with added fertilizer. And an added tip: if you're reusing a container from last year, dump the old mix into the compost pile or use it to amend a planting bed. Start the new tomato season with a clean container and fresh mix. So, what is the best fertilizer? Most soil-less mixes are very low in nutrient content and don't hold on to nutrients very long. I recommend adding a slow-release fertilizer prior to potting up your plant and supplementing with a soluble fertilizer throughout the season. And even though tomato plants can be heavy feeders, too much of a good thing that can lead to all leaf and no fruit. So what tomatoes grow best in a container? Well, there are so many tomato varieties from which to choose. There are big slicers, sweet cherry selections, plum, sauce tomatoes, etc. There are traditional colors, yellows, greens, even striped forms. For that choice, I'll leave you on your own. But there are some types that are better than others in a container system. Indeterminate varieties are those that grow and fruit seemingly forever. I've seen commercial greenhouse tomato crops with vines up to 40 feet long. Not a great choice for a patio container. And while size can be an issue for a container tomato, the advantage of indeterminates is a long fruiting season. I keep my tomato pot next to a large trellis to support the long and heavy vines. Determinate varieties grow to a certain scale and then stop growing and set to produce fruit. While the smaller plants lend themselves to container culture, they produce ripe fruit during a shorter season. Then you have to choose between heirloom and modern varieties. The heirlooms have the reputation of having better flavor but more potential for disease problems, while modern varieties have disease resistance bred into their background but are said to have less flavor. In my book, any tomato you grow at home and pick fresh is going to have far better flavor than any supermarket tomato. Pick the type of tomato you want and the growth type you need and chase your own holy grail. Well, that sounds like good advice. From BetterHomesAndGardens.com, 37 summer flowers you don't have to water all the time. These colorful summer flowers thrive in the garden without a lot of watering, by Miranda Crowell. Masses of colorful summer flowers bring undeniable cheer to a gardener. A skyrocketing water bill? Not so much. But there are plenty of flowers that can handle the summer heat without demanding you water them all the time. Like all plants, they'll need more frequent watering while they're young. But once these summer blooming beauties are established, you can keep the hose wound up most days or even take a vacation, and the flowers will keep coming. First on the list is African daisy. Silvery foliage contrasts with vibrant flowers in African daisy plants. If you live in a mild climate, African daisies will do fine without an abundance of water. In high heat, the flower will close up and require more water. Grows well in zones 9 to 11. Number 2, Anise hyssop. The tall nectar-producing flowers of Anise hyssop will draw pollinators aplenty to your summer garden. Both the foliage and colorful flowers of this perennial also add delightful fragrance. Grows in zones 4 through 10. Black-eyed Susan is next, a garden staple for good reason. Drought-tolerant black-eyed Susan bring the color from midsummer all the way through fall when many other flowers fade. They come in both annual and perennial varieties. Grows in zones 3 through 11. Blanket flower is next. The blooms just keep coming when you plant a blanket flower in your garden. Native to American prairies, the plant can handle poor soil and drought, making it an especially good option for rock gardens. Grows zones 3 through 10. Borage, number 5. The vibrant blue flowers of borage aren't just striking in an herb garden. They're edible, too. Toss them into salads, drinks, or desserts. Grows in zones 2 through 11. Celosia, number 6. For summer flowers that look otherworldly, dry celosia. Some look like small flames, others like candles, and still others like ocean coral. But all love the heat, and most varieties are drought tolerant. Celosia grows in zones 10 through 11. Coneflower. With their long, colorful petals and distinctive cone-shaped centers, coneflowers are irresistible to both gardeners and pollinators. The perennial comes in single and double varieties and in colors ranging from hot reds and oranges to cool pastel pink. Grows zones 3 through 9. Catmint, number 8. For a plant that is sure to thrive without a lot of fuss, it's hard to beat catmint. These hard-working perennials bloom with pretty purple flowers even in poor soil and are rarely bothered by deer or pests. Grows in zones 3 through 9. Coreopsis. The bright flowers of Coreopsis herald the beginning of summer, and the plants keep on blooming all season long through heat and humidity. Deadhead the flowers regularly to encourage more buds to form, but be sure to leave a few flowers on the plant. Birds love their seeds. Grows in zones 3 through 9. Cosmos. Cosmos may look delicate on their thin stems, but the plants don't actually require much fuss. In fact, these annuals stand up well to dry conditions once they're established. Breeders have played up the romance of this flower, creating single, semi-double, and fully double in a variety of pretty hues. Number 11 is daylily. Midsummer is when the flowers of daylilies make their debut, unfurling gorgeous petals in a huge spectrum of colors and shapes from spider to ruffled. These fast-growing perennials are surprisingly resilient and handle drought well. Grows in zones 3 through 10. Dianthus, number 12. Dianthus may be best known as a spring flower, but breeders have produced many cultivars that can handle the heat of summer without a ton of water. Varieties range from tough ground covers to taller varieties that are perfect for vases. Grows in zones 3 through 10. Next is French marigold. As companions in vegetable beds or showcased in a pot, French marigolds evoke the bright and sunny days of summer. The annuals are available in double, pom-pom, and single-petal varieties, grow easily from seed, and do well without much water once they're established. Number 14 is pink evening primrose. At the end of a long day, the cheerful flowers of pink evening primrose is a welcome sight. The fragrant cup flowers open white and mature to pink. Though this is a native perennial, the plants tend to spread easily, in some areas quite aggressively, so sight it where it can sprawl. Grows in zones 3 through 11. Globe amaranth is next. Globe amaranth produces tiny white flowers, but its stiff, bright magenta bracts are what really stand out in gardens or in vases. An annual in most places, though it can grow as a short-lived perennial in zones 2 through 8, globe amaranth will bloom even in drought conditions from summer through fall. Next on the list, geraniums. There are plenty of reasons geraniums adorn so many gardens, pots, and window boxes. They don't just produce colorful flowers in summer, but hold up in hot, low water conditions too. Of the various types of geraniums, zonal varieties do best in the heat. Grows well in zones 10 through 11, and a tip, water in the morning and apply a layer of mulch that's about 2 to 3 inches thick around the base of plants to minimize water loss to evaporation. Jerusalem sage is next. Loads of lemon yellow flowers on Jerusalem sage will draw pollinators to your yard from spring through summer. The shrub's velvety leaves, which look pretty on their own too, remain evergreen in zones 8 through 10. A sturdy member of the mint family, it does just fine without a lot of water. And next on the list is kangaroo paw. As befits any Australian native, kangaroo paw handles hot, dry conditions beautifully. It's little surprise that it's becoming increasingly popular in drought-prone regions in the U.S. Expect the plant to shoot up quickly and unfurl its unusual club-shaped flower buds. Grows well in zones 10 through 11. And there's a tip, kangaroo paw is a perennial only in the warmest climates. If you live in a cooler region, you could still grow it as a summer annual. Or display it in a pot in summer and let it overwinter indoors until the following summer. Lamb's ear, number 19. Lamb's ear is best known for its velvety, silvery leaves and stems. Come summer, many varieties of this reliable low-water plant send up flowers in pink, purple, red, or white. The plant reseeds easily, so if you want to limit its spread, remove the flowers as soon as they fade. Grows well in zones 4 through 9. Lantana, number 20. With varieties that range from upright to trailing and offering an array of flower colors, Lantana is a versatile player in a summer garden. Clusters of small tubular flowers, which often have a tie-dye effect, draw the eye, and plenty of pollinators too. Grows in zones 8 through 11. And a warning, Lantana is an invasive plant in California, Florida, Hawaii, and Texas. If you choose to include it in your garden, confine it in containers and deadhead it regularly to limit seed production. Lavender is next. Lavender is a staple of Mediterranean gardens, thanks to its romantic quality and ability to withstand dry, hot weather. There are hundreds of varieties of this herb, from hardy English lavenders to earlier blooming Spanish types. Grows in zones 5 through 9. Milkweed. Best known for providing essential food for monarch butterfly caterpillars, milkweed produces large clusters of flowers in summer that attract all sorts of pollinators. These North American natives are very adaptable to drought conditions, too. Grows in zones 3 through 9. Moss rose. Next, moss rose is adapted to dry, desert-like conditions, which means it basks in the summer heat and thrives with very little water. This annual plant features a trailing habit and single, semi, double, or fully double flowers in jewel tones, or less commonly, pastels. Grows in zones 10 through 11. Next on the list is mullein. Mullein comes in tons of sizes and colors, but what they all have in common is a resilience in the face of low water conditions once they're established. Their spires of showy flowers look gorgeous in a cottage garden and attract pollinators. Grows in zones 3 through 10. Penstemon, number 25. Whatever style or size garden you have, there's a pretty low water penstemon for you. Whether it's a dwarf alpine plant or a prairie variety that reaches for the sky, the stems are covered in little flowers of various colors. Penstemon grows in zones 3 through 9. Perennial salvia. There are hundreds of perennial salvia species, and the majority of them are easy-growing, low-water performers in the garden. Their flowers are versatile and favorites for cottage-style perennial borders as well as meadow gardens. Grows zones 3 through 10. Next on the list is sea holly. Sea holly is known and loved for its toughness, silvery foliage, and thistle-like blue flowers. They don't need a lot of water, and in fact hate soggy soil, to bloom throughout summer into fall. Come winter, the spent flowers even look interesting enough to leave on their stems. Grows in zones 4 through 8. Russian sage. The individual lavender flowers may be tiny on Russian sage, but as they bloom together on tall wands, they make a big impact. The more sun they get, the happier these fragrant perennials will be. Grows in zones 4 through 9. Sedum, 29. A massive family of plants, sedum comes in all sorts of varieties that produce sweet summer flowers without much water at all. They vary greatly in height and foliage, ranges from needle-like to broad, rounded, paddle-like leaves. Grows in zones 3 through 10. Spider flower. Despite what its name may suggest, spider flower is a real charmer in the garden. Ideal for the back of the border, these annuals reach up to 5 feet tall without requiring staking and bloom with pink, white, and purple flowers that evoke the tropics. Grows in zones 2 through 11. Stokes aster, number 31. Native to the southeastern U.S., Stokes aster typically blooms from spring all the way through fall, requiring very little water along the way. It's a go-to plant for cottage gardens. Grows in zones 5 through 9. Next on the list is Summer Snapdragon. Summer Snapdragon has made a big impression since it was introduced in the 1990s thanks to flower spikes that handle heat and humidity well. Its flowers resemble true snapdragons, though they're not related. In zones 9 to 11, it can be grown as a perennial, in others, as an annual. Verbena number 33, you won't need to water verbena often for it to thrive. In fact, the plant is known to pop up between cracks in the pavement. Let this flowering beauty cascade from hanging baskets, spread as a ground cover in a rock garden, or climb a trellis. Grows in zones 7 through 9. Veronica, number 34. Whether producing flowers on tall spikes or low to the ground, Veronica, also known as Speedwell, makes any sunny garden bed more interesting. The summer blooming varieties of this perennial tend to be taller and rebloom more often than other types. Grows in zones 3 through 11. Next on the list is Yarrow. Tough but sweet, Yarrow handles drought conditions and poor soil extremely well. Its cheerful clusters of flowers and colors ranging from white to yellow to coral-top fern-like foliage, making the plant a versatile player in both cottage and meadow gardens. Grows in zones 3 through 9. Yucca, number 36. The spiky foliage of yucca creates an architectural foil to the white flowers that it shoots up in summer. You can keep the hose coiled. Yuccas dislike water. In fact, they're prone to root rot if they get too much water. Grows in zones 4 through 11. Finally, number 37 is zinnia. While zinnia seedlings need moist soil as they grow, once plants are established, they're remarkably drought-tolerant. The cheerful summer annuals are favorites of beginning gardeners, including kids, for their low-fuss nature and long-lasting colorful blooms. Grows in zones 2 through 11. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy, and we'll be talking with you soon.